This podcast is supported by Americans for Medical Progress and was founded and created through the Michael D. Hare Fellowship, awarded annually to support projects that inform and educate the public about the critical role of animal research in furthering medical progress. The fellowship honors the late Dr. Michael Hare, a renowned board-certified laboratory animal veterinarian who dedicated his career to scientific and medical advancements and who was deeply committed to animal welfare and advocacy. Hey, everybody. Welcome into this episode of Lab Rat Chat. I just want to remind everybody, I know I said in the previous episode that I wasn't going to do this anymore, and I stopped for a little while, but I'm going to do it again. It's really helpful when people rate and review and go to Apple Podcasts, go to iTunes, go to Stitcher, go to Google Podcasts, wherever you can rate and review our show. It really is helpful. I told myself I wouldn't say it anymore, but since I stopped, we've gotten no reviews. And so we were getting like, I mean, it's not like we have tens and thousands. You know, we have 30 something, maybe 40. I haven't looked in a while, but they were kind of like slowly rolling in as we did that with every episode. And then I stopped and then the review stopped. So please do tell your friends, family, encourage others to listen with an open mind. You know, you can rate and review it honestly. You know, we're not asking for a 5-star rating from everybody. So, you know, give us your feedback. You can email us labratchat@gmail.com. That's one way to get in contact with us. You can also just Google Lab Rat Chat. We'll come up for Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. You can contact us that way as well. So don't hesitate to reach out if you have comments or feedback. And speaking of that, we've got feedback from a listener. And today we have that listener, Lindsay Bader, who is a senior research associate at Oregon National Primate Research Center. And Lindsay, if you will, first of all, thanks for listening to our show and thanks for giving us feedback on a previous episode about enrichment and all that kind of stuff in laboratories and giving animal treats. We appreciate it and we value your thoughts. And we're glad that you're able to join us today and kind of talk to us about non-human primates specifically in research. But before we get into everything, just tell our listeners a little bit about you and your background and kind of where you are at in your career today.
Hi, thank you both for having me. I am as you mentioned, a senior research associate in Dr. Paul Kibet's lab. He's in the Department of Cardiometabolic Health. So we focus on obesity-related research using primarily non-human primates, but there are some rodent studies that he does as well. I am not involved in that research, so I don't know anything about it, aside from what I hear presented at lab meetings and that he talks about in general. My primary responsibility right now, the project that I focus on the majority of my time on, is a group of 25 cynomolgus macaques. They're on a study for a pharmaceutical company where we do various drug trials with them. And they are in various size groups. And how I got here originally was many years ago, a family friend happened to know a PI who worked at the Primate Center and had mentioned to her that I was, you know, I had graduated from college and I was looking for kind of a more serious job to get into. I was just kind of not really sure what to do with my degree. Plus I liked working with animals. And she was like, well, you know, why doesn't she apply at the Primate Center? And so I did. And I got into a lab with Dr. Judy Cameron initially. And then I transferred over to Dr. Kevin Grove's lab and eventually Dr. Paul Kibet's lab. And I've just kind of always had an interest in animals growing up. In college, I briefly volunteered at a wildlife rehab center. I've had a variety of pets. I have dogs. I got pretty interested in doing positive reinforcement training with my dogs to start with. And then I started doing it more with the monkeys. I was involved in some projects to train them for a variety of voluntary behaviors. And it was the best thing ever. And it just, those first couple of years at the Primate Center just really got me hooked. And I really fell in love with macaques. And the research is fascinating. I'm learning things constantly. There's so many smart people at the Primate Center. I get to hear about all sorts of research. I get to interact with so many different people across the departments, across different job positions, and learn a wide variety of skills. It's a really amazing place to work. And I've been there for 17 years now.
That's awesome. I know we wanted to talk today, you know, about the behavior and the enrichment with the non-human primates specifically. I guess before we jump into that, could you give our listeners a little bit of background about the Oregon National Primate Research Center, such as, you know, areas of research, types of non-human primates that are there, types of housing, those aspects?
Yeah, absolutely. The Oregon Center is one of 7 national primate centers in the U.S. We currently house about 5,000 non-human primates, and the species are, it's predominantly rhesus macaques, but we also have Japanese macaques, cynomolgus macaques, as I mentioned, that I work with predominantly right now. There's a small number of squirrel monkeys and baboons, and the areas of research, as I mentioned, I'm in the division of cardiometabolic health, so we're focused on obesity-related research, but there's also research going on in aging, AIDS, and various other infectious diseases, depression, alcohol and drug use disorders. There's a reproductive department who has a wide variety of studies going on. There's cell and gene therapies. There's a lot of really cool research going on.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. And it's great learning about all the different National Primate Research Centers. I wasn't too aware of the National Primate Research Centers, to be honest, until, you know, I spent that summer at Tulane. And then if, you know, for listeners of the show, if you listen back to episode 6, I think, we talked to the director of the Tulane National Primate Research Center and let our listeners learn about that center. And so it's kind of nice that we're getting kind of exposure to our audience to what you guys are all doing, trying to accomplish at the centers. I think it's really awesome, and it's not being done, you know, anywhere else outside of the NPRC. So it's really cool. So we've talked a lot about on this show about enrichment, why it's a necessity from an animal welfare and scientific study perspective. But today, let's focus more on like non-human primates, because we've talked about that more in relation to mice and rats. So is there anything different, like from a regulatory standpoint, per se, like the Animal Welfare Act or otherwise, in regards to how enrichment programs are operated when you have non-human primates involved?
Yeah, it is part of the requirement that they have to have enrichment. You are looking to do whatever you can to increase species-specific behaviors. So if they're an animal that spends a large time allotment naturally doing foraging, you want to do what you can to try to simulate that behavior and give them as much as possible devices and opportunities to forage for food. That comes in a variety of ways, in a variety of devices. We have a whole behavioral services unit on campus who is very skilled at this. They're very creative and they're very innovative in coming up with different materials and new devices to use. And they're also really great to collaborate with and get really excited when we want to come up with like new devices and think up new ways to give the animals more opportunities to express behaviors that are normal for them. But you can have like foraging boards where you can take, maybe animals are on a specific diet and they can only have specific types of foods, specific regular diets. So what you can do is, you know, put those diets into different devices that they have to spend time carefully picking out. You can put them on a tray with different holes in it. So again, you can pick it out. If they're, you know, some animals, like they may be health-wise restricted as far as they can't have hard items to eat because of dental work that has happened. So you can, they'll come up with ways to soften, moisten, and freeze food items so that it's a little more interesting for the animals to manipulate. You can freeze things inside of various tubes so it takes them longer to get at and they spend more time figuring out how to get the food out of the tubes. There's a wide variety of things that you can do. And you can have, olfactory enrichment. You can have TVs in the room to show different pictures, to show different approved movies. There's sound that you can have in the room. So most of our rooms, I'm pretty sure the vast majority, have radios in them. And they have pre-recorded nature sounds. They have sometimes different radio stations, usually a classical radio station on it. There's toys inside of the cages. So the animals, like there's a minimum that there has to be one toy per animal, say, for various enclosures. So there's a whole plethora of toys that you can put inside that cage. Maybe some animals have very sensitive equipment that is attached to their housing, so they can't have hard plastic toys. So, okay, they can have rubber toys. That might work. If that isn't working, you can hang all sorts of devices on the outside of the cage so that they don't have, while the equipment is attached to the cage, like touch screens and things like that, they still have items that they can manipulate, interact with, mouth, do whatever it is that that particular animal chooses to do, hanging on the outside of the cage. You remove the equipment and then they can have toys inside the cage. So there's a wide variety of options available for how you can give enrichment to the animals.
I have to ask, because you very specifically said approved movies. Are we talking like PG-13 movies or rated R? Like, what is the cutoff for what is approved for viewing?
That is an excellent question. I do have to admit, I don't remember specifically. I think they try not to go above like a PG rating.
It's That's more like awesome.
Cartoons and things like that. There's some nature movies and whatnot. Yeah.
You very specifically said approved movies, and that just made me think, what would not be approved?
I don't want anyone to think that they're getting to watch, you know, very violent movies. Like, we don't put, 300 into the room and watch them and get them watch ancient Romans hacking off each other's heads.
No Planet of the Apes. Let's not give them ideas.
Oh, that's funny. So, I also wanted to kind of ask about social group housing, because our listeners may or may not know, obviously social grouping is a requirement for non-human primates and other animals within biomedical research, but this is to address their social needs. So how does a facility such as your own sort of ensure that compatible non-human primates are housed together to avoid fighting? And I know before we started recording today, you had mentioned puberty for the non-human primates, which also kind of lends itself to this question. So yeah, if you could just kind of go over how that is worked out.
Yeah. So again, our behavioral services unit, they have many very experienced people working on this. There's also workshops available that you can go to. There's the macaque. Oh boy, I hope I don't butcher this. I don't have it saying right in front of me to get the correct name.
We butcher things all the time. It's totally fine.
Okay. So yeah, the macaque pair housing workshop is really great to help broaden anybody's experience who works with socially housed animals and wants to, you know, think about how to better assess if pairs are working out, if groups are working out, what to look for, some things that you can think about if you're wanting to create new pairs, new groups for studies. But generally speaking, there's a wide variety of things that we can do at our center. I will speak to the group of cynomolgus macaques that I work with, because that I feel like we've had to use a variety of things with those guys. Because unfortunately, groups that start out fine don't indefinitely stay fine with each other for the rest of their lives. So you do have some squabbles that occur and some wounding that can occur that necessitate a particular animal not going back to the group. So in introducing that one animal to either another partner or another group, we always start with some form of protected contact for both animals. So it may be putting them into neutral housing with various dividers that you start off with minimal visual contact, but they obviously have olfactory, contact, but they can smell each other. Then you gradually move up to, like, we have a wide mesh slide that we put in, so they have visual contact with each other, and it's not quite grooming contact, but they can stick fingers through. So, and anytime you move up to a decreased level of protected contact, there's always multiple people there, at least one other person there who can put a slide in place, another slide in place to safely protect both parties if one or both of the animals starts aggressing towards the other one, because we obviously don't want any injuries. So we go up to a slide that is a wide mesh so that they can have more access, and we can start to assess, like, how do they respond to each other? Is there a clear dominance hierarchy? Because with macaques, they operate on a social hierarchy system where you have a dominant and everybody else is less dominant and subordinate to that animal. Depending on the size of the group, you may have just a dominant and a subordinate, a dominant, a beta, and a low-ranking male. And it goes on and on. So what you're looking for is not only just a lack of aggression, but you're hopefully going to see the animals starting to suss out who is the dominant animal and who is the subordinate animal. Because when they fit into those roles with each other, you're more likely to have success when you gradually move up to full contact. It's a little trickier when you have animals where it does not appear that one animal is subordinate to the other, because that can cause tension, which can lead to physical fighting. And depending on the animals involved, some animals are if you put two animals who are very used to being the dominant animals together, it may not work out very well for both parties because neither one wants to be the subordinate. And you can usually figure that out pretty quickly if they start, if there's contact up against the slide and they start aggressing towards each other. That's usually where we call it. It's like, okay, this is not going to work. This is not worth the possibility of wounding for the animals. And it's obviously not as, if they're aggressing towards each other, it's not great for their psychological well-being either. So then you move up to grooming contact where they can stick an entire arm through these bars in the slide and then up to full contact. And depending on how many animals you're trying to put together, you may take a, if you have a group, you want to create a group of five, you may do a stepwise fashion where you try multiple pairs together and put them within visual contact of each other. You can try different caging in the room to see how they all respond to each other. You can try it in large, if you have access to larger spaces, once you feel that everyone is comfortable with each other, you can try various tunnels, having animals in tunnels where they can see each other and they can reach between bars. We have a variety of equipment that we can use. And as the boys have gone through puberty, some of them have, I don't want to say want, but some of them have increased their social ranking. We actually have one particular male who went from being the lowest ranking male to now he's the beta in a group of 9 animals. And in the process of doing that, there's some fights that have occurred. So we have some animals who just cannot get along in that particular group. So we find them appropriate partners from that group and we have them in a different enclosure. And then we've, as they've continued to go through puberty, we've had some other dust ups where an animal who had always been subordinate, we have no idea really what changed, but he started becoming the more dominant animal. And the animal who had previously been the dominant animal did not accept this change. So they got into a fight and the wounds were, they were severe enough to require suturing and whatnot. Thankfully, we were there when it happened, so we could immediately get them apart, get them separated, distract them, get one of them into a tunnel and pull them out. And so we've started the process of introducing animals. We'll use like our tunnel. We'll have an animal in the tunnel and we'll put it up to another enclosure and see how that particular animal responds to the other animals in the group, how the other animals in the group respond to that particular male. And if the response is positive, then we'll start by putting that animal with the dominant animal in a pairing cage and we'll start the slide increasing process to see how they get along until they move up to full contact. It's really interesting when you're involved in it, and it's really cool to think about. And it's like very complicated kind of Tetris game that if you're into this, it's really cool. If you're not into this, this is probably not the most interesting thing to hear me talk about.
I had no concept of all of this that went on until I spent that summer at Tulane and I did an externship at Wake Forest and they had a similar process. And it blows my mind really how, I mean, it's like an all day, every day, like you said, kind of puzzle that they're trying to like piece together. And sometimes it seems like they've got it all right. And then all of a sudden, two monkeys in another cage start fighting and they try to put them together again, maybe like they'll give them a second chance and they fight again. And then that's it. And now you got to like reorganize everything. And it seems like it wouldn't be that hard if you have, you know, 10 monkeys, but when you have hundreds of them, you know, and you're trying to sort this all out, it was hard to wrap my head around how they could even manage it. I mean, and it's crazy how they knew. I mean, I know you're not really technically supposed to like give the monkeys names, but they did. They had names for monkeys and they knew every monkey's name, their behavior and who they could be with and who they've been with already and who they just weren't compatible with and who they might be compatible with. It seemed very complicated. And I was just like, you know what? You guys are the, whatever you say, you just tell me where to go.
It's like social cliques in high school.
Yes.
Speaking of suturing, I think I doubled my suturing experience or tripled within like my 3-week period at one of these institutions.
If it was during breeding season or baby season, probably.
Yeah, there's definitely fights, but I mean, they're always working on them and trying to regroup them and find the right, you know, match for them. So it was cool. Very complicated and something I don't understand how they're able to get it right. It just seems... You're explaining it very well, and hopefully our listeners understand that it's quite the process, and it's not just like, oh, put A with B, and that doesn't work, put B with C.
Right. You don't just throw them in the cage and be like, well, we'll see if this works out. If not, it's a very involved process.
So we've talked a lot about enrichment now, and well, I guess not too much enrichment. We did a little bit, and then just group housing and pairing them together and psychological well-being. So if a protocol submitted to the IACUC requesting that the animal not be housed with other animals for any reason, let's say they need to be singly housed, not be paired, or not need any sort of enrichment provided, like what's kind of, how does the IACUC handle that kind of situation? Or how does the behavioral group handle that sort of situation? Or does that even happen where you are?
I will fully admit that I don't know the specifics of anyone who has tried to submit for that. Aside from, I do know of people requesting single housing, but the animals are never completely isolated. They may be in an individual cage, but they will be in at least a room with multiple other animals. The requirement is that they, at the minimum, have to have visual contact with, at the minimum, one other animal. And so the way that our rooms are set up, that is not difficult to accomplish. If they're not at least pair housed, they at the minimum have visual contact. It may not seem like they can still establish social hierarchies within the room, even if they don't have physical contact with each other, but that does actually occur in a room that has established animals. You will see that if an animal needs to be sedated for a physical exam or for a procedure, some animals will react much more strongly with vocalizing, with physical actions. They might shake a cage. They might throw a toy around if a particular animal is getting sedated, as opposed to another animal in the room they might not react very much to. So social hierarchies occur regardless of whether the animal has physical access to a conspecific or not. But at the minimum, it's getting harder and harder. They also have to justify. They have to give scientific justification for singly housing an animal. They're getting stricter and stricter about qualifications for that and how to justify that. The investigator can't just walk in and be like, I want this animal singly housed. And they're like, okay.
Right. Yeah. And we've talked about some of that justification before, even just in regards to mice and rats. And it's difficult. I mean, in the end, you can't just justify it saying like, I want this animal to be singly housed because it's easier from a husbandry standpoint or something. You know, it's easier for my research team to manage the cage or something. So yeah, it's a very scientific or like medical reason.
From kind of that same perspective, I guess, because there's so many people working with these primates, I guess, how could an error or somebody not sort of satisfying some of these requirements of each study have a negative impact on the research? Because I'm sort of thinking in terms of, say you have a NPO, don't feed this monkey, but say someone sneaks in and gives it a treat or something like that, because there's so many people in and out of these rooms on different teams. I guess sort of implications for the study, you know, what does that do for you guys if something is given to the animals that maybe shouldn't have been?
It's a very unfortunate thing. There are multiple negative outcomes from that. One, that animal is not being fasted just for kicks. They're being fat. That's another one of those things that when you have to put it into your IACUC if you're going to be fasting animals and why and what the duration is and all of these things. It's not something where you, again, it's not one of those casual things where you're like, this animal could have food withheld for this amount of time. That's not how that works. So for an NPO, they are going to be fasted for a specific reason, whether that is related to animal welfare reasons. So say the animal is going to be sedated for a procedure. There may be a fear of the animal vomiting and regurgitating and aspirating, especially if an animal is going to have a surgical procedure and they need to be intubated. There's a high concern that they could vomit and aspirate during that time. So if they are fed anything, that potentially will cause that animal to vomit, aspirate, and in a severe case, the animal could die because of that. So it's not a casual request when an animal is requested to be fasted. So there's the animal welfare aspect of it. There's also the scientific aspect of it for particular procedures, for particular studies. Maybe an animal has to be, maybe somebody's doing a study where they're looking at, and I'm sorry, I'm not being very specific about this because I'm blanking on it, but specific gut juices. And so they need the animal to be fasted for a certain amount of time before they receive an oral compound and a certain amount of time after the fact. If somebody feeds that animal, they negate potentially the whole purpose of the study and they're canceling out, you know, they're throwing a variable into the study that was not accounted for. So especially if somebody thinks that they're harmlessly sneaking in some food to the animal because they feel bad that it's being fasted, they're potentially creating data that is not accurate. So if the investigator or any of the study staff doesn't know that this animal was fed and they're reporting the data, I mean, this is potentially data that's going to be published in a journal and people are going to be asking about it. And when they ask questions like, you know, what are the methods for this study? What was, you know, did you fast this animal? I'm like, absolutely. The animal was absolutely fasted, had no food on board. It's like, well, actually, you might have these outlier animals or you might have these data points that you can't explain because somebody fed the animal and you didn't know about it. So sneaking in and feeding an animal or even feeding an animal that's supposed to be fasted regardless, like you are potentially impacting the study results and the investigator may have no idea that this happened and they're reporting this data. And to the best of their knowledge, they're reporting that this animal was fasted when in fact it actually wasn't. With diet-related studies, which, like I said, we focus on obesity-related research. So our animals, like we have specific diets that we feed. We do have specific fasting requirements for the animals. Anytime that we're doing blood sampling, we look at a lot of fasting glucose and insulin. We're assessing animals for type 2 diabetes status. So if we have somebody who's feeding the animals during a period when we thought that they were otherwise fasted, we may be getting these elevated glucose and insulin values. And so we think an animal is diabetic. So we go through all the procedures that we have to go through, which is also a separate thing. And so maybe we start treating the animal with insulin. Well, this animal we didn't know had been getting fed when it was supposed to be fasted, maybe getting treated with insulin and therefore going hypoglycemic because the animal's not actually diabetic. It's just getting fed when it wasn't supposed to. And all measures that we were collecting pointed to it being diabetic when in fact it was just that the animal had food on board.
Yeah, that's kind of an issue. Yeah.
It is. There's talk about reproducibility of data and problems with that. Well, I mean, maybe it's harder to reproduce some data because animals that you thought were fasted actually weren't. So, I mean, that plays into that.
It's a difficult area. I mean, you have so many people involved in and husbandry and care of the animals. And I think so many people look forward to that aspect of the job and making that bond and giving them a little treat and moving on and not always understanding the negative impacts that that may have. It's more just like, oh, what harm can one little treat do? And I mean, and then we have to take in the human component of just emotions and the emotional side of the work. But I mean, yeah, it's a fine line to try to balance. Like, hey, like these animals really can't be fed treats because it's really going to, for the sake of the animal's life and contribution to medicine and the sake of the study as well. I mean, we just really can't feed the animal. But I think that's just a hard concept to get across, but that makes sense.
There's a lot of negative fallout that can happen from that. Say you were doing, the animal was going to be euthanized, and that's the reason why the animal was being fasted. And you're collecting tissues that are going out to a wide variety of investigators. They're specifically requesting tissues from an animal in a fasted state. And once there's food on board, that kicks off a lot of biological responses and the tissues just are not the same in a fed versus a fasted state. So people may have invested so much time and money into these tissues. And especially, unfortunately, if it's the whole reason that this animal was euthanized was for the collection of these tissues and somebody went in and fed the animal, that's a pretty heavy.
Heavy is a good word to describe it. I was trying to think that's like heartbreaking.
It is.
To
it
absolutely waste an animal, is. Kind of.
It is incredibly hard.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it sounds like from back and forth email communications, you guys are doing a lot to try to manage that. And I know other institutions have the same issues from what I've heard and talked to people about as well. So it goes on everywhere. You know, everyone, we all enjoy, as we know, obesity is a big problem just in our pets and dogs and cats. We love giving animals treats.
Yeah.
And it's hard to not, when they're sitting in the room and there's, you know, some pepperonis right there, you just want to give them a couple.
You can tell your rotation was at a clinical vet's office recently. You got pepperonis on the mind.
Yeah, we're giving pepperonis today. It's like we said, it's kind of a fine line to try to balance like the human at emotion side and then the study side. And
yeah, hopefully our listeners, you know, maybe we're able to kind of set a few light bulbs off for, you know, people who work in this industry and maybe they get a different perspective and something maybe will click for them at their institution. You know, that would be a good outcome of this.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen cages in places where I've been where they sit, says like the Rimpio and if it's, or says it's being fasted. And I mean, if you see it on a cage, don't give the animal.
There's food. A reason. Right.
Yeah. There's a reason.
Please, no food.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you don't understand why, I mean, go ask the investigator, go ask somebody, like, why can't these animals have food? And I think if you hear why, maybe that'll help. Like, oh, now I understand why I can't, and the negative impacts, and how it just kind of destroys everything in a way. So, but thanks for bringing that up and explaining that aspect of things. Because, I mean, we always talk about enrichment and giving them all these treats and all that. So it's nice to hear, you know, sometimes they can't, and these are the reasons why you shouldn't. Anyways, I don't want to beat that to death, but just moving on. I kind of ask all of our guests. Yeah, I didn't have a good segue for that.
In fact, you used a pretty decent pun there, unfortunately.
Yeah. I'm asking all our guests kind of, you know, what they say to people. And it sounds like you've been in this career field for a long time, so I'm sure you've had the opportunity to talk to lots of people, both friends, family, and strangers, about your what you do for a living. You know, and we used to always say, you know, when you're out at like a party or on an airplane, which things are, I mean, back to normal, but when you're traveling or you're out somewhere and someone asks you, you know, what you do for a living, do you tell them, openly tell them like what you do when it comes to animal research? Have you ever had any crazy reactions? And if you have, I'd like to hear it.
I've had some funny reactions, but yeah, I kind of usually ease into my answer and I assess a few things. One, am I in a position where I'm ready to like actually spend some time talking about it? Because usually saying what I do generates a lot of questions. So if I am really not in a place where I really want to have a lot of public conversation or just general conversation about what I do, then I will be very general about it. Be like, I'm involved in research. Like, oh, okay, cool. Like, and who is your employer? You know, and I'll say, oh, it's OHSU. I can be very broad and general. Sometimes when I'm like, okay, I'm ready to have this conversation with somebody and kind of tell them, usually it's when I'm like, all right, I'm going to talk about all the great things and like my animals are freaking amazing. They're a lot of work, but they're totally worth it. So I feel like I have a lot of cool things I can tell them about the animals I get to work with. And it's a really unique, cool job. So when I'm like in the headspace where I'm like, okay, I'll have this conversation, I will still kind of ease into it and be like, oh, I'm involved in, you know, I'll say something like, I'm involved in biomedical research. Not everybody picks up on that as working with animals. I'm like, oh, what do you do? And I'll be like, oh, well, I actually work on, you know, projects involving monkeys. I'm like, oh, and then I kind of ease into it and kind of explain more. Usually, I don't get a super negative response. Occasionally, I will get some very uneducated responses. So I did have one person who was a lawyer, and he asked me, he was like, oh, do you guys still put shoe polish in rabbit eyes?
What?
Yeah. It was like, so I'm pretty sure that's propaganda that was put out in the 80s that still gets circulated now. And that absolutely doesn't happen.
Okay.
No, I don't put shoe polish in anyone's eyes.
I've never even heard that before.
But do people even put shoe polish on their shoes anymore?
I don't think so. It was a very dated, very like, think about what you're saying. And, you know, and I was like, why do you think someone would put shoe polish in an animal's eye in the first place? I don't know, because blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, you know, and then I went into an explanation about, you know, what actually goes on. And it's important to think about the sources that you're getting the information from. And if they're very biased, as we know that some sources are very much so, you need to take what they have to say with a grain of salt. And maybe you need to explore options by talking to people who actually work in the field, who can give you actual, you know, stories of what they actually do, as opposed to somebody who has that particular agenda. That currently is the most
the top, yeah.
Bizarre response that I've gotten.
Yeah, I had to just try to, I've never heard that. So I just wanted to try to Google shoe polish and rabbit's eyes. And I just get information about Polish rabbits.
Vaguely remember it from the 80s. I think it was I remember it as some animal rights organization. I remember pamphlets, and I vaguely remember it.
Like, okay, it wasn't part of the ad for the shoe polish, like tested in rabbit eyes.
No.
Get your shoe polish from us.
Yeah. Look how shiny their eyes are. Don't you used to look this way?
Yeah. Oh, no, that's a marketing campaign. Oh, gosh. That's awesome. Well, I'm glad that you were hopefully able to shed some light to that gentleman and set him on a better path. Oh man, yeah. That's really funny. So we've kind of reached the end of, you know, what we wanted to touch on today. And we did go over a lot of awesome stuff. Do you have any final thoughts? Maybe things we didn't cover? Just anything you want to get out to our listeners?
The only thing I can think of is just that I want everybody to know that the people who are working with the animals really care about them. That's the whole reason why they're there. You need people who, you know, have these skill sets to work directly with the animals, because it is an involved, very involved job. And there's a lot to think about. And especially now with COVID and everything, it just makes everything more challenging. It's really cool though. Like, it's a really unique job and it's a really cool job to have. And it's a really cool opportunity to get the chance to work with monkeys on a regular basis, because they're just, they're phenomenal.
Yeah, they're definitely interesting. They'll keep you busy. But I mean, I appreciate you being willing to come on and talk to us today. I know our listeners have got a lot out of what you had to say. I learned a lot because, I mean, I know we've talked about this before, but every time we have guests on the show, Danielle, I think we've known like one of them, maybe two of them beforehand. And so we're always kind of learning about our guests and what you do as we're speaking over the course of this episode, the last, you know, 40 minutes or so. So it's been fascinating to listen to. You've shed a lot of great information that we can all take away. So thanks, Lindsay, for coming on and talking to us and for listening. Like I said, if anybody out there has, you know, feedback for us, let us know. You email us, labratchat@gmail.com. You can sign up for our newsletter at the American for Medical Progress website. You can follow us on social media. And I think that's it for this episode. So again, thank you, Lindsay. Thanks, Danielle. And we'll catch everybody next time. Take care, everybody.